The question was asked, being that we learned that there is a prohibition of lotis go to do, we're not allowed to get together in groups. The Torah doesn't want us to do things that are overtly different in one city or in one shul. So then how does that apply today in our cities where you have Ashkenazim and Sfardim and Timanim, etc.? I can't answer you halacha lemaise too much in this short setting, but we'll try to get basic understandings. Yes, sir.
Doesn't that refer to something like idolatrous, not
didu? Lotis go didu? Yes, but the Talmud says lotis go didu is to take a knife and scratch oneself. I think that's what the Talmud says. But the Talmud also applied it to this agudot agudot. Yeah, David.
In Seattle, right, where I lived for a couple of years, they had two Sephardic shuls, which eventually split off because the minhagim were so different. But they couldn't split off the Ashkenazic shul. And Chol HaMoed, you will see about half the shul wearing tefillin and half the shul not, because they couldn't agree.
Okay. So mate, we'll try to deal with that a little bit. Just a second. David, you want something?
I don't have to swing the chicken over my head, right? I can keep doing the double bag with coins.
Let's do halacha l'maaseh then. But yes. Yes, sir.
Well, I can? Hold on. I can keep doing the coins thing?
Yeah, why not?
Because...
Wait, let's... So if we cover it, then let's see... after we cover it, if you still have a question, we'll... cover it. Yes.
No, when you take the word minhag and spell it backwards, this was told to me by many rabbis. You take the word minhag and spell it backwards, Gehenna. Now, what does that mean? I really didn't understand.
It's a good question. It's not a new thought. The Mordechai quotes it in Gittin in the name of Rabbeinu Tam, and it's quoted in Halacha. This concept that minhag and Gehenna are the same letters, but that's not for this conversation. If you want, after this, we'll get to that. Okay. Let's go back to. What we were discussing, which was the concept of lotis go dudu. Technically, we have a concept of a minhag, as we discussed earlier, where we don't only do that which it says in the Torah and the Talmud, we also have customs that are valid customs. And it seems like the next question we're going to deal with is going to be, well, what is a valid custom? So that we'll get to. But leaving that aside, once you have a valid custom, so then it's obligatory upon the people of that town. Yeah, the world used to be different than it is today. The way the world used to be was a person was born into a certain town, which is where his parents were born, which is where their parents were born, and people pretty much stayed in the same area. Once every few years you had one guy who was... he was going to go and see the world, he was going to go and see another town, he got a shidduch from another town. But once upon a time, it was pretty much, you know, you were born here, you were going to date the girls that were from here, and you were going to marry and live here. And even if you dated a girl from another town, she was going to move and live with you here. And you were going to continue building your life here. The Talmud even says the common practice was when a person married off his first son, he'd build him a home. That was a given. Oh, we learned it in Megillah, Bet Chatnut Libno, that one of the things that are prohibited during times of mourning, during times when a person is supposed to be sad, is building a house that's a house of rejoicing. What's a house of rejoicing? That's the house you build for the first son you're marrying off. So it was pretty much a given that people stayed in the same town. You sometimes had situations where there was a pogrom or where Jews were expelled, and then communities had to shift. But more or less, Jews stayed in the same place. Places had customs. The customs dated back hundreds and sometimes over 1,000 years. And those customs were halachically binding for this locale. If a Jew moved from Ashkenaz to Sfarad, now that he moved in, he bought a house, or he's renting an apartment, he's staying in Sfarad, he must take on Sfarad customs. Now, that's his custom. He just moved there. He takes on their customs. A Jew moved from Chutz Arts to Eretz Yisrael, he's obligated to take on the minhagim of Eretz Yisrael. Once upon a time, there was such a thing. There were the customs of Israel.
What? What would be a good example of that?
A person moves from a town where they don't do work on the eve of Pesach in the morning to a town where they do work. He could now do work on the eve of Pesach in the morning. Some towns have the custom they don't do any work on the morning before Pesach. Other towns have the custom that they do. I'm not talking about in Israel. I'm talking about two different towns. You said an example. That's an example. In today's day and age, we would say it might be how long you wait between meat and milk. Or it might be...
Different
areas have different customs as to how long they wait between meat and milk. It might be the custom of wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed or not wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. When it comes to customs, we are obligated to do in accordance with the custom of the place we live in, provided that that place has a set custom. This was the halacha up until about 70 years ago. Then things changed, and we'll discuss that in a second. Yes, Ariel?
Why is wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed or not a custom? Is it accustomed to wear it on Shabbat or not? Is there a halacha to do it or not? The rest of the week is there a halacha or not? So shouldn't Chol HaMoed be the same? It's either you do or you don't. It just depends how you understand halacha. It's not so much your custom.
I'll ask you a different question. Whether you put back dry food on the plata on Shabbos, isn't that just a question of how you understand halacha? It is a Gemara in Shabbos, and yet there are two different customs as to how we understand halacha.
Well,
Sephardi and Ashkenazi. It's halacha, but how do you define the halacha in an area where it's a machloket dating back to Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel? You have those that rule this way and those that rule that way. Most of us don't have beards long enough to decide what the halacha is on a machloket that all the giants have argued for the last three millennium, you know. So then how do I know what I'm supposed to do?
If you cover your arms or not with some sort of sleeve?
I don't think so. That it seems to say in the Gemara you should. But this is a different conversation here. Let's not go into details yet. Let's first understand the. It's a machloket in halacha, and there are two different customs as to how you go. But that's we're taking examples, and our point isn't to take apart examples, but to understand the specific concept. When the Torah tells us lo tisgodudu, and we can't break up into groups, so there, with regard to lo tisgodudu, that applies firstly to halachot, and also to customs. We were just explaining how customs worked once upon a time. And being that your question is going to focus on customs, so we're going to go with that to a larger extent. But technically, what Ariel is saying is correct. A lot of the issues are issues of halacha. How long you wait between meat and milk is halacha and Shulchan Aruch. But who we go like in halacha, well, we have different customs who we go like. Even though technically you're right, it's a discussion in halacha. It's a discussion in halacha whether you could take soup from the fridge that's already been fully cooked and put it back on the covered fire, one pot on top of another pot. However, the halacha defines to do it, is there bishalach or bishal belach or not? It's a machloket in halacha, machloket in doraita, and we have different minagim as to how we run that. A person doesn't just say, well, let's see. To me, it seems like this. No, we're not big enough to do that. No one ever did that. They had tradition and they derived it, and we don't have tradition strong enough nor knowledge that is powerful enough. What?
You'll never do that?
No.
It seems to me he rejected a lot of things that were Ashkenazi practice, and he changed a lot of things.
So let's discuss that on a one-by-one basis after we finish this. We could discuss that, but we got to take each point on its own. One thing at a time. So back to lo tisgodudu. We are told by the Torah that we can't divide a city. So Rabbi Yossi of Galilee was of the opinion that one may eat chicken together with milk. The rabbis disagreed. Rabbi Yossi of Galilee, Rabbi Yossi of Galilee. We rule not like that. We rule that it's rabbinically prohibited. Now in Rav Yossi's town in the Galilee, there was a time when he was chief rabbi and they'd be eating chicken with milk. And they were right for doing so because he had shoulders broad enough to have such an opinion. There was a person who decided that you have to slaughter fish. He said you have to get a good knife and slaughter them just like you slaughter animals. So the rabbis sent their police force and they told him, if you tell anyone that anymore, we're going to beat you up. You have two choices. You don't know what you're talking about and you have to decide. Are you going to go in line with tradition and stop telling people that, or our police force is going to take care of you. I don't remember the name. It's a Gemara in Chulin. It's also a Medrash Rabbah. He wasn't a Tana. That's the point.
Some guy.
Some person who the Talmud quotes. I don't remember his name. So, if Rav Yossi Aglili had an opinion and the rabbis didn't tell him that, that means the rabbis held he was big enough and he was allowed to have that opinion. And it was a valid opinion, and his congregation went in line with his opinion. Then the years went on, and he was outnumbered in the courts. The courts ruled against him, and all of Israel today, we are prohibited from eating chicken with milk. We treat chicken just like meat, even though technically meat is biblical, chicken is rabbinic. There can be a difference in halacha. Let's say I want to eat rice milk together with chicken. So there's a prohibition of Marisayan. I want to eat almond milk together with chicken. So technically, the only prohibition is to eat cow's milk or to drink milk with meat, animal milk, with kosher animal milk with meat, that's prohibited. But what we call almond milk or rice milk, that's not prohibited at all. It's only a problem of Marisayan. It looks like you're doing something prohibited. The guy sees you with this cup of white milk, and you're eating your burger and drinking, looks bad, right? So we say there would be a difference between if it's asu biblically or rabbinically with regard to how careful you have to be. Do you have to leave almonds floating on top of the milk? Let's just finish one point. Do you have to leave almonds floating by the milk? Do you have to leave or not? How far you have to be careful with Marisayan? There would be an aspect where if it's biblical or rabbinic, there would be a difference. But technically, from our perspective, whether you eat chicken or eat milk, you wait your 6 hours before you drink milk. Let's try to finish a point. The Torah tells us, let's say I moved into regular territory. I used to live by Rabbi Yossi Aglili's town, and now I'm going to live somewhere else. So I'm obligated to the rulings elsewhere. I can't come here and say, well, where I come from, they eat chicken with milk. Let's say I live back in Rav Yossi Aglili's time. And if a person would come into town and say, I'm a student of Rav Yossi's yeshiva, everyone here could eat chicken with milk. The restaurants come, they all want me to give them a badat certificate, they're going to start serving chicken with milk. Cheeseburgers, you know, chicken burgers, cheese chicken. The rabbis come to me and tell me, in this town, we rule not like Rav Yossi Aglili. In this town, we rule it's prohibited. If I'd be going against them, we have in the town a court, and we have two different rulings in the town. That's a biblical prohibition of Lotus Godu. You're not allowed to make groups within Israel. There's one court, and everyone has to adhere to the court. This is in Halacha, and it even goes so far as a minhag. So, up until 70 years ago, it was very clear. You came to a town, and there was the custom of the town. Either you did do work on the morning before Pesach, or you didn't do work. And if you came from a town where they did do work, and you came into a town where they did not do work, you would be prohibited from doing work. You can't go against the custom of the town. Now,
isn't that a specific example where that actually does apply as opposed to somebody else where it wouldn't? That's what was explained to me.
I'm not following your question, but let's finish and then let's take questions, because I think we're going off on tangents. People won't be able to follow. So let's all be on the same page and then let's take questions. So I'll get to you, David. Unless you're not understanding something, if it's a different question, let's wait.
It's on this very subject.
So fine. Okay. Let's wait. Let's just finish and then everyone here seems to have questions. So when it comes to minhag, technically, things should be the same. But the Talmud tells us, this already dates back to the Talmud. It's a Gemara in Baba Basra. Gemara says that if a whole town moves, then the town takes along the minhagim together. We don't say, the minhagim, they stay in Radin. The whole town of Radin moved to Israel, now we take on Israeli minhagim. No, an individual gets swallowed up by a community. But a community doesn't get swallowed up. So here we came to Israel, and you have whole communities that came here, and you can no longer say there's a minhag Eretz Yisrael. You know, once upon a time there was a minhag Eretz Yisrael. The minhag was, let's say, that women would cover their hair with two hair coverings, not one. People tell me all kinds of things. Minhag Eretz Yisrael. So I ask him, does your wife cover your hair twice? He says, why should she do that? I say, that's the ancient Minhag Eretz Yisrael. If you're going to start telling me Minhag Eretz Yisrael, so do you do every other Minhag Eretz Yisrael? When you walk down to the chuppah. So the Minhag Eretz Yisrael is that the two fathers walk down the bride and the two mothers walk down the two fathers walk down the groom and the two mothers walk down the bride. That's Minhag Eretz Yisrael. That's the ancient Minhag here. Now, today, there are two customs. Wait, no questions.
What about that?
Wait, in a minute, you can ask everything you want. In Chutzlaritz you go, you see, there are two customs. Some people have the father and the mother walk down the bride and the groom, and some people have two fathers and two mothers walk down the bride and the groom. Two different customs. Here, there was a minhag. I don't know if there still is. You go to some chasnas, they do it this way, some they do it that way. So today, the majority of the Jews here are not Jews from Israel. And the majority of the Jews here have different customs than Minhag Eretz Yisrael. So today, the halacha says, we retain our old customs. Why are we doing Minhag Ashkenaz? Ashkenaz is Germany. What do I have to do with Germany? So my grandfather was in Germany. I moved to Israel. But I'm not the only one that moved to Israel. And I didn't move into a place where I'm outnumbered. I moved into a place where there are 10,000 Ashkenazi Jews or 100,000 Ashkenazi Jews, and there are 100,000 Sephardi Jews, and there are 100,000 Moroccan Jews, and maybe 30,000 Yemenite Jews or 40,000. I don't know the numbers, I'm just saying. That's why our minhagim didn't disappear. So you have a shul next door that's Ashkenazi, you have all Yitzchak, and next door to him you have a Sephardi shul. And being that we are whole communities, really, so we don't say, well, it's Jerusalem, you all have to adhere to Jerusalem's minhag. There is no Jerusalem minhag. There is no one court in Jerusalem. There are many communities within Jerusalem, and we're all living within one another. So how do we apply Los Yisgodudu? That's all good and nice, but then how do we apply it? So we say it applies either in a minhag that all of Israel has. Throughout Israel, you'll be hard-pressed to find. I don't know if it exists. A shul that will put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. I haven't heard of one.
I know a bunch. Yeah.
When I first came here, so I came from Chutz La'aretz, and in Chutz La'aretz you have some minyanim do and some don't. You can find a shul that doesn't, a shul that doesn't. So if you go to a shul that puts on tefillin, you're not allowed to change from the minhag of the place. You have to put on tefillin. You go to a shul that doesn't, you're not allowed to change from the minhag of the place. You don't. If your custom is that you do, so put it on privately at home before you go to shul. If you're going to daven in a shul that does not put on tefillin, but your custom is that you do, so then you should really put it on at home beforehand, and then you go to shul and you won't put on tefillin. If your custom is that you don't put on tefillin and you're going to go to a shul that does, then you have to do like them. You have to put on tefillin. We are bound by the minhag because of Los Yisgodudu. Within the shul, we cannot change overtly. Anything that is discernible is prohibited. So, if I'm an Ashkenazi in a Sephardi shul today, the Sephardim, they all stand for some parts of tefillah, and they all sit for other parts of tefillah. We Ashkenazim have slightly different customs as to where we stand and sit. So if people aren't so careful about it in shul, let's say Kaddish, certain Kaddishim, the Sephardim sit, and we Ashkenazim, we stand for every Kaddish. So if you're in a Kaddish where some of the guys in shul are standing, some are sitting, you could stand. Yeah, you could go with your Ashkenazi custom. But if the whole shul sits, and you're going to be the only one standing, you're not supposed to change from the custom. Then it's Los Yisgodudu. No questions yet. I'll try to hear all the questions in a minute. The other application, Yehuda, so far you with me? Because you were the one who asked the original question. The other application of this would be, if all of Israel has a custom, like we said, I thought all of Israel had the custom of not putting on tefillin. As far as I knew, I mean, when I came here a decade and a half ago about, I was looking for a shul that puts on tefillin so that I could put on tefillin. I'd be forced to put on tefillin if I davened there. And I couldn't find one, and anyone I asked said they had never heard of a minyan here in Israel that puts on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. So you're saying there are a bunch.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know if that's new or the people I spoke to didn't know. I don't know. At the end of the day, it's a question. It's questionable. I mean, if you have a custom that all of Israel does, then you can't go against it. That's why when they wanted to start making a second day Yom Tov here in Israel, I was told, I don't know if this is true, I was told that The custom of Israel was that even the people from Chutz Lartz who were visiting did not do a second day Yom Tov, at least here in Jerusalem. That was the custom. That's what Rav Salant, the rabbi of Jerusalem, held. So then they went to Rav Kook Zatzal and they asked him for permission. And he said, okay, but they can't walk around publicly in their Yom Tov clothing on the second day Yom Tov after Yom Tov. They can't show that they're going against the custom. If they want to, so he told them how to do it in a quiet way. They shouldn't overtly go against the custom. If here in Jerusalem the custom was, at least that's what I was told, that the custom was, this goes back about 50 or 60 years, I guess more, if Rav Kook was still alive. If the custom was that even the people visiting would not keep 2 days Yom Tov, he said, if you want to change from the given custom here, you have to do it privately, you have to do it quietly, you can't do it overtly. Now again, the practical applications of this, you see from all the questions everyone has, they're too numerous to go into, each one we'll have to deal with on its own basis. The only place where we could discuss halacha lemaisa is what we mentioned, and that's where it's very relevant for you guys. If you're going to a Sephardi shul and you're Ashkenazi, or an Ashkenazi shul and you are Sephardi, whatever you say quietly, whatever no one else knows what you're doing, you stick to your own custom. Whatever is going to be overt, then you're bound by their custom. So if they do tachanon right after Shmon Esrei, you got to do it with them. If they do tachanon at the end, so you got to do it the way they do. However they do, that's overt. When you put your head down is overt. What kedusha you're going to say, or what order you're going to say your psukei de zimra, if you're going to begin with hodu or baruch shomer, that no one knows the difference what you're doing, so you stick to your own custom. Yehuda, are you happy?
Yes, I have an additional question, but I know everyone else has too.
So. Okay, so I don't know who was first.
I just have a real simple question. Does it apply to guests, a one-time guest, the way that it would apply to somebody who picks that as their shul?
A guest in a shul? It's the same thing, yeah.
Even if you're there, just if we're talking about your one time. To a Sephardi shul, you can't stand for guys?
We're talking about a guest. I mean, the same thing with tefillin. If everyone's sitting, you have to sit like them, correct. We're talking about one-time guests, yes. David.
You're talking about how the rabbinate in Israel hold by one custom. Well, there's one straight halakha.
I didn't say that. I didn't mention the rabbanut at all. Where did the rabbanut get into this?
Well, you said something about does that do like kashrut and like it's all?
We didn't discuss kashrut.
There aren't two standards.
That's a totally different question. That's not. There's nothing to do. I mean, that's a totally different question. I'm saying the applications. Obviously, you have to. We have to. That's what I began with. This would take 2 days to go into the applications. Yeah.
Sure. Right, well, let's just say there's this nice Orthodox Hasidic Jew from Poland. Then he goes to Yemen. And that is Pesach. Can he eat the rice?
Has he moved to Yemen?
Like, he's been living there for 3-4 years.
He doesn't have, right, once he's moved, once he moved, if his parnas is there, he's bought a house there, once he's moved to Yemen, he takes on the Yemenite customs.
What if he moves to Eretz Israel, but in an area predominantly Sephardi, all Sephardi shuls, Sephardi families? And he's living in that neighborhood forever.
Let him ask his local Orthodox rabbi.
And his local Orthodox rabbi is Sephardi.
Let him ask his local Orthodox rabbi.
I'm just saying about that. Why can't an Ashkenazi rely on the Torah says that it's ridiculous to not get Yom Tov Pesach? His Torah is very Ashkenazi, is it not?
I don't think the Torah says something. The Torah calls it a minhag shtut. Okay, show me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, this is the connection. What happens if you don't know your father's community and you live in an area that there is no Jewish community really to follow minhagim?
So now we're going into a conversation about minhagim, which is fine.